Lectures. Last Friday, I wrapped up our discussion of perturbative quantum gravity on Minkowski space. I briefly talked about the necessity to gauge fix the path integral. Well, if you don't do that, then you're integrating over redundant kind of gauge directions, which gives you an infinity, an extra infinity. Really, the right way to do it should be in this perturbative context, according to the so-called Fadeev Popov method, where you gauge fix, but also have special other terms appearing in the action from which you then compute Feynman rules. I wrote down the propagator for you in harmonic gauge, and also, not intentionally to scare you, but told you that the first non-trivial, I mean, three-valent vertex, graviton vertex, consists of more than 100 terms. And of course, it gets worse from there. Then I also briefly talked about the perturbative non-renormalizability of that theory. And I gave you a simple dimensional arguments based on the dimensionality of the coupling constant, Newton's constant, Gn, which is squared inverse mass dimension, to say, well, really the divergences, well, we expect at loop order, but say the theory is such that they get worse, the divergences get worse at every order, and that's an indication of the theory being not renormalizable. So it's impossible to absorb these divergences by a finite number of redefinitions of couplings that go into the action. I also cited some key results about, well, what happens at given order in either pure gravity or matter-coupled gravity. And people have explicitly verified that for pure gravity at two loop order, the series diverges. So the coefficient doesn't vanish by some accident. And for matter coupled, this already happens at one loop order. I said, well, in principle, this doesn't mean that one necessarily has to throw away this perturbative prescription, because the modern way of thinking about quantum field theories is anyway one where you say, well, you specify a range of energies where the theory is supposed to be good and valid, and just once you get outside that range, well, then it no longer applies. So in principle, as long as relevant masses or momentum parameters in your computation are much, much smaller than the Planck scale, then that could still make a good approximation. Now, this perturbative series. Now, of course, unfortunately, we're in a situation where quantum gravitational effects are already very weak. So if you're now confining yourself, you have to confine yourself by the construction of this perturbative series to a region where, well, masses are small compared to the Planck mass, then, of course, that raises the issue, are there any reasonable, interesting things you can compute at all that could then be compared with experiment? There are such calculations. For example, you can just try and figure out what is the first order quantum correction, lowest order quantum correction to something like Newton's law. People have made these computations, of course, under the assumptions that you're in a regime where perturbation theory is still valid. But of course, then numerically, these effects you compute are just minuscule, and they are therefore highly unlikely to be verified. So one is a little bit stuck with this approach. And of course, it also raises a more fundamental question. Is one, well, the perturbative non-renormalizability, is one doing something wrong here, or does it mean no quantum theory exists? Or are there any loopholes? Are there any ways around that? And this is the thing we're going to talk about next. Of course, first you can ask yourself, was there anything perhaps wrong with my splitting up g mu nu into background metric eta mu nu plus some local perturbation F mu nu. Well, this must be small, clearly. Well, if you extrapolate, well, if you keep on using it for F large, what are indications that we are just doing something quite wrong? Well, one indication is, for example, that this G mu nu is actually, it's not an unconstrained linear bunch of linear variables, because you have an inequality on the determinant of G mu nu. So actually, physical metrics, of course, always satisfy that the determinant, first of all, is non-vanishing, but it's smaller than zero. Yeah. So obviously, if I allow here for arbitrary perturbations F mu nu that can get arbitrarily large, that easily violates, and of course can have either sign, that easily violates this condition. So clearly there's something, well, clearly this is not universal. So one already gets here one other idea. That one is maybe missing out information. So really, if you're sitting, what one is really doing here, see, if this is kind of the big kind of configuration space of gravity, or so let it, it doesn't matter now whether I talk about metrics or geometries, then eta mu nu is here one point in it. And what one does really is one linearizes kind of the space around eta mu nu. That is what this procedure does. So one could call that kind of a tangent space quantization. But of course, this space, I mean the configuration space of gravity proper, is certainly not a linear space at all. So although we don't know too much about it, right? What I gave you last week was to say, well, this is, it has a somewhat complicated structure of a quotient space of all Lorentzian, of course, non-degenerate form metrics on a given manifold M, where I identify two whenever I can reach one from the other by a diffeomorphism, a gauge transformation. So this is a complicated and certainly a non-linear space. Okay, so that, of course, always means that it's impossible to parameterize it by vector space variables, by linear variables. So it's clear that this kind of cannot capture any non-trivial features of the space. Okay, another way, not necessarily unrelated, another point one can make is maybe, is it just possible that we are, that perturbation theory could be valid, but what we're doing is we're perturbing around the wrong vacuum. So it's maybe the true vacuum of the theory, something that's not kind of some classical nice eta mu nu, but something quite different. Could it be that this is, well, it looks at a large scale, kind of my vacuum state looks like this, but maybe microscopically this is no longer true. So that would mean that this is actually not perhaps a good way or a good region of your configuration space to look at. You should be maybe perturbing around a different vacuum. And this is another train of thought which one can follow and kind of draw consequences from. So, are we perhaps is eta mu nu not my true vacuum? Now, maybe my true vacuum has little resemblance to any kind of smooth classical metric, not just the eta mu nu. Okay, that also brings on in general to the idea that, or to the question, can I define kind of quantum theories or quantization procedures where I take into account metrics that are not just merely those that are infinitesimally close to my given chosen metric, typically iter mu nu, but that explore kind of the space, even classically, the space of all curved geometries in a better, more efficient way. I mean, this space really is the one I'm talking about here. So that's really what one means by a non-perturbative quantization or quantum theory. So that is one that includes, you know, I'm saying that in a slightly hand-waving way, includes configurations as they appear in some way in the quantum theory. That could be kind of as a carrier space of wave functions, or as the space of things you integrate over in the path integral. That includes configurations which are in some way to be specified kind of quantitatively far away from any kind of classical space-time. So that's a kind of a definition of really what one means by non-perturbative. So it's really to be contrasted to a linearized relation like this one. And we'll really spend the next 2 weeks by studying how this might be done and what people have done to try and achieve this. And there are essentially, again, two slightly different ways of doing that. You can do it via a route of canonical quantization, where you then talk about operators, you introduce a 3+1 split, and you can do it in a more covariant formulation where you don't make a split between space and time to start with, and then attempt some evaluation of a path integral of some kind. Now, there's another way of characterizing these two methods is to say, well, one is really kind of quantizing a classical picture based on the Hamiltonian formalism, where the kind of Hamiltonian, in this case it will be a Hamiltonian constraint, but Hamiltonian stands central and I'm working with configuration variables and conjugate momenta. The covariant way of quantizing would be to take as one starting point the Lagrangian formulation of the theory and the action and work with configuration variables and kind of second order equations of motion. What we'll do here is I start by doing it the Hamiltonian way, and I very, very briefly remind you of some of the structures as they appear in classical finite dimensional Hamiltonian mechanics, because, you know, this, of course, this formalism will carry over first to the field theoretic case for gravity, and then we'll quantize that along analogous lines. So let me just start by this. This should be very familiar stuff, I hope. This is Hamiltonian mechanics for n degrees of freedom. Well, one does usually start off with an action or a Lagrangian in that case. So the starting point is some Lagrangian, which is the sum over the n degrees of freedom of some kinetic term, m half qi dot squared, standard kinetic term, minus some q-dependent potential. And what I now have to do is to perform a Legendre transformation. And of course, the first step is always to work out what are the conjugate momenta to my variables qi, and they're defined, as you know, as pi is partial differential of L with respect to the velocity, the corresponding velocity with index I. And of course, sticking in using this explicit expression, this is m qi dot. And now rewriting L, substituting dependence on q dot by dependence on p, defines the Hamiltonian. So that is, of course, always of the form pi qi dot minus h. So you just rewrite this expression with the p's. So you always have, this is also kind of, this is a standard term, of course, that appears. And that, of course, defines then what h is as a function of q and p, configuration variables and conjugate momenta. So that defines the Hamiltonian h. H of qi and pi, and which is in the simple case is nothing but 1 divided by 2m. Let me use a vectorial notation now instead of the index I, p squared plus v of q. Now, what is an important feature for us that will play a role in the quantization is that on the so-called phase space, so that's the space spanned by the QIs and the PIs, there is an algebraic structure given to you in terms of this, the Poisson bracket. And the simple coordinate functions QI, PI on this phase space obey what is called canonical Poisson brackets, where a QI and a PJ Poisson commutes to delta IJ, whereas a QI with a QJ always has Poisson brackets 0, and similarly for two different or equal PIs. So another way, more formal way of saying that is to say that the phase space, and let me give this a name, which I'll be using in what follows, curly S, of course, it is simply, in our case, an R to N, because each of the Qs and each of the Ps can just take arbitrary real values, that it carries specific structure, which is called a symplectic structure. And that is really just rephrasing that we have something like, well, that we call Poisson brackets. And it really is, I get back to this point, it's really a Lie algebra structure, because you take two phase space functions, so functions element, there's an element, the functions on S. You take two of them, you take their Poisson bracket, and what appears on the right-hand side is another element of the same set here. So this, by this, the presence of this symplectic structure, C infinity, I did want to write, C infinity of S is turned into a Lie algebra. So let me spell this out. So this is my kind of symplectic structure. So that's what I write. That's how I might write it, the Poisson brackets. They have three slots where I can put phase space function in. And so this is a function that needs defined on the Cartesian product of C infinity S with itself and gives rise to another C infinity function. And let me just write down here what the properties, further defining properties of this structure are. So this is the Poisson brackets. They obey the following properties. F, Poisson bracket with G, is antisymmetric. So if I exchange the arguments, G and F, I pick up a minus sign. Furthermore, it's linear. So if in one of the arguments, you know, I have consists of a sum of two terms, I can split it up into different pieces. So say here I have a G plus lambda H, where lambda is just a constant that gives me an F Poisson bracket G plus lambda I can pull out of the brackets F Poisson bracket with H. So this here was antisymmetry. And the second is linearity. And thirdly, and importantly, we have something, we have a Jacobi identity. So that means if I take three functions, and apply Poisson brackets twice, so I take, say, Poisson brackets of G and H, and then the resulting function, Poisson bracket with F, and I add terms which are just cyclic permutations of the arguments, the functional arguments, G with Poisson bracket of H with F, plus H Poisson bracket with the Poisson bracket F and G, these add up to zero. So that's a Jacobi identity. If this looks a little bit abstract as a set of properties, you're most likely, you are just familiar with working on this phase space R to N, where you have global coordinates, which are these QIs and PIs, and then an explicit representation of these Poisson brackets is given by the following. So it's valid globally, as I said, for the special case of a phase space R2n. But of course, there are also kind of, if you like, more interesting phase spaces that are not linear. Yes, but then these symplectic properties continue to hold. But then you are at least assured that you can locally always find coordinates that look as if you were working on the standard R2n, and these are called Darboux coordinates. So that's something, of course, one has to show that they exist, but it's completely clear that they do exist for the simple case of R2n. So in Darboux coordinates, that simply means these are the coordinates that make your life simple. even for a general symplectic manifold, this is how to compute the Poisson bracket of two functions that depend on these arguments. Take a sum over all degrees of freedom from 1 to n, takes the partial derivative df dqi d del g del pi minus del f del pi del g del qi. So I hope this is familiar to you from your mechanics course. And I can also use this Poisson bracket notation to write down the Hamiltonian equations of motion. Yeah. So what are those? Or Hamilton equations of motion, I should say. And what I'm interested in primarily kind of is how the QIs and the PIs behave as a function of time, because that will describe just then the dynamical evolution of my system. So using the Poisson brackets, QI dot is equal to QI Poisson bracket with the classical Hamiltonian. And of course, you see, if I use this definition up here, I only get a contribution from the first term, because this argument is, of course, only seen by the QI, and that gives me a 1. And what remains is then a dh by dpi. Del h, which in my simple case here would be a pi divided by m. And you have a similar first order relations for pi dot, and that is given by Poisson bracket now of pi with the Hamiltonian. And if you substitute it into this definition here, you see that only the second term contributes now with a minus sign, minus del h by del qi. And of course, what you get here is minus dv, the potential derivative with respect to the coordinate qi. So what you see then here is kind of the standard feature of writing down Hamiltonian dynamics. For a system with n degrees of freedom, you find 2n first order in time equations of motion. Of course, if you want to, you can substitute one into the other. You can substitute this here back into this equation, and then you get, of course, a second order equation, a single one. So pi dot, using this expression here, can be written as a linear function of the qi dot. So that gives me then an m times qi double dot. And by the second equation, that should be equal to the gradient of your potential vi. And that is, of course, your standard way of writing the equation of motion as a second order equation in time, as it comes out of the Lagrangian formalism, if I had used that. So one thing that might be still useful when we think about we think about structures that are associated with defining this dynamical system on phase space, what one can think of as any given phase space function as doing is it defines a flow. So actually, to start with, it defines a vector field on the entire phase space. So in every point on the phase space, there is kind of a direction. If I integrate these up, these directions, then, for instance, if I was talking about the vector field associated with the Hamiltonian itself, I would find the trajectories of the system as it behaves under time. But I can associate with each phase space function, the coordinate functions are special examples. I can define a so-called Hamiltonian vector field associated with it on phase space. And I can, if I want, that defines then a certain flow, and I can integrate this flow up uniquely, because that's a kind of first order system, to find the explicit trajectories it generates on phase space. So let me just write this down a little bit for completeness and perhaps later usage. Any function on phase space, which I call little f, can be associated with a vector field on phase space. It's called a Hamiltonian vector field. And the association goes via this symplectic structure or via the Poisson brackets. So this is the symbol for the vector field, capital X. And because it's associated with a function little f, it gets this index here. And it's defined to be the Poisson bracket with the function f. And if I write it, you see, if I use this notation here, it just is this thing here where I'm not putting an argument into the second slot, which means one of these derivatives will just stay as a derivative. Yeah. So sum over I df dqi minus, sorry, del by del pi minus df by dpi d by dqi. So I have, of course, this neat way of thinking of, first of all, these are partial differentials, right? But of course, there's a kind of a dual interpretation of those as elementary vector fields in my coordinate directions, right? So, and of course, I have this 2n dimensional space, so a complete basis of this is given in terms of 2n vectors. And of course, the d by dpi and d by dqi give me exactly a complete set. And those are the coefficients. These are just functional coefficients. So you see that, indeed, this is a vector field, as I'm claiming, on the phase space. Yeah? And, well, this is, I hope, a kind of an obvious notation for this. But keep that at the back of your mind. You know, each phase space function has an associated kind of field of directions, a vector field. So a vector at any point in phase space that is characteristic for this function. And it leads to a kind of geometric way, for example, of what it means to solve the equations of motion. It just means I follow, as I look at the vector field associated with H, and I just integrate it up along the flow lines given to me by this associated Hamiltonian vector field, subject, of course, to some specific initial conditions. OK. Now, what is the relevant, why is this interesting to study this classical structure when we now want to talk about a quantum theory, a canonical quantum theory? Well, the presence of the symplectic structure, or equivalently the Poisson brackets, gives an additional algebraic structure that encodes just some properties of the classical system. And whenever I have something like this, my intention is, when quantizing it, to preserve kind of as much as possible of the classical structure at the level of the quantum theory, because it's just information about the system, which I may want in some way to recover or to find back in the quantum theory. So what I now mean by a canonical quantization of this very simple system with the S equal to R to N, something I had already written down, I think, last week. We talked about this in some context. I associate QI and PI, which are the coordinate functions, with self-adjoint operators, QI hat, PI hat, and I kind of represent what was classically the Poisson brackets by the commutator of corresponding operators, which I've divided by IH bar. These are the quantities that will appear on the right-hand side of the quantum commutators, where classically this was just a factor one. Okay, this is, of course, the H bar is the quantum part. And what becomes of the canonical Poisson brackets is, of course, that QI hat, QJ hat, operators commuter zero, PI hat, PJ hat, likewise, and the only non-trivial relation are the ones where I take the commutator of a QI with a corresponding PJ hat, and that gives rise to a factor IH bar. So this looks kind of very, very neat in a way. These are our familiar canonical commutators from Schrödinger-type quantum mechanics. And what, in addition, is very neat about it, if I pose the question this way, I say, OK, these are the things I want to quantize in the first place. I want these classical Poisson relations to be preserved. Then there is essentially up to unitary equivalence, just one way of doing it. So there is one representation of these algebraic relations in terms of self-adjoint operators. Great, so there's no further thinking involved. It's essentially unique. Okay, this association, classical with quantum. Let me write this down. So if really I start with the classical analog of these relations, well, they were on some previous backboard, then I have an essentially unique representation. I mean, that's what's usually called the Schrödinger representation. Terms of self-adjoint or Hermitian, as they're also sometimes called, self-adjoint operators. And that's such an important result that it has a name. It's the so-called Stone-von Neumann theorem von Neumann. And just to emphasize, I haven't said anything about how I quantize general phase-based function. This is only a statement about this basic commutator algebra of the QIs and the PIs. And that is quite sufficient for what one usually wants to do, right? Because we started out with a Hamiltonian that was a rather simple function, erased now, of the Qs and Ps, that actually whose quantization, of course, I'm also primarily interested in, because I want to solve the quantum dynamics of this Hamiltonian operator. But I obtain it in a straightforward way by substituting, you know, whenever I see a classical QI by its quantum analog, and similarly for the PIs. And then I just get a second order differential operator as my quantum Hamiltonian. So what I'm getting here, following, you know, staying in this representation, I get a quantized Hamiltonian, which is 1 divided by 2m, sum over all pi hat squared plus the v of qi hat. But of course, in the standard representation on configuration spaces, the pi's will be partial derivatives with respect to the qi's. And the qi's will just be represented by multiplication by qi. So I have a straightforward and unique way of plugging these elementary operators, qi hat, pi hat, into the Hamiltonian, the classical Hamiltonian, and getting a unique kind of quantum operator out. And then I have to just understand what is the spectrum of this quantum Hamiltonian. So that's my well-defined quantum system. And this is just, well, there are no ambiguities in this game. Now, the issue is now, well, this was a very special and especially simple system. Can I use this type of prescription for more general classical, say, even finite dimensional systems to associate with them a unique quantum theory? So that's kind of a question that Dirac posed a long time ago. So let me call it, kind of in his honor, Dirac's canonical quantization program. That basically says, can I elevate this to a general prescription? What we just did for the simple system. General. So really, in a nutshell, what one wants to do is to say, OK, give me any classical dynamical system in its Hamiltonian form. I have the Poisson from brackets classically. I have loads of phase-based functions. Maybe I don't want to consider all of them, but I want to consider certainly the Hamiltonian. And is there now any way I can think of some unique prescription that associates that with a quantum system? so that the classical Poisson brackets go over into quantum commutators of self-adjoint operators. And already Dirac realized that this couldn't possibly be done if one's aim is to quantize arbitrary phase space functions. So not just, you know, a small set of selected ones. Now, why is that so? Well, one reason for why this is so, an important reason, is what goes by the name of factor ordering problems. So that stand in the way of making this unique association while preserving kind of the algebraic symplectic structure at the quantum level. Now you see, so the way we proceeded in this simple previous example was to say, aha, well, I had a classical Hamiltonian, but, well, in this case, it has some functional dependence on my basic variables, the q's and the p's. Let me just look, just stick in. Wherever I see a q, let me stick in a q I had. Wherever I see a p, let me put in a p I had. Now here, no problems arose because this is the q's and p's never mix. So this is exclusively dependent on the q's, and this is just dependent on the p's. And of course, you recall that I had only non-trivial commutator relations when I had a q with a p. So however, a factor ordering problem appears when I am asked to quantize something that's like, say, a qi, pi, no sum, right? Because if I quantize it this way, because of the non-trivial commutator brackets, it's not the same as if I quantized it that way, right? Classically, these two things commute, so one is as good as the other. But it's not true at the quantum level. So you can already see if I had an interesting operator I wanted to quantize that depended, say, on such a binomial term, well, there seems at least an ambiguity. Can one maybe resolve this by making additional, putting additional conditions on the system, or to resolve this ambiguity in some way? Well, let me phrase this slightly formally by posing the following question. Is there something I want to call a quantization map? So that's kind of a magic wand. Let me call it capital Q, which associates with every smooth phase-space function a self-adjoint operator. So let me call this a set of the self-adjoint operators on some Hilbert space, acting on some Hilbert space. Let's keep things simple, and let me keep my phase space just an R to N. So that just specifies what the operators should be. That should be nice. There should be standard self-adjoint things. So F dagger equal to F. So they really, the spectrum has a direct physical interpretation. Is there such a map? Q of F equal to this F hat, such that it obeys a bunch of properties we'd love it to have. Okay, firstly, QI is mapped to QI hat, and QI hat is simply given by multiplication, as usual, of the wave function psi of q. Pi is represented by pi hat, which as usual is given by a partial differential. Pi hat psi of q, the wave function, is minus I h bar d by dqi psi of q. And now, the second thing is that we want to preserve the algebraic structure on the set of all phase-space functions in the quantum theory as commutators. So for any pair of classical functions f and g, we would like that if I take their quantum commutator, this should be IH bar times the classical function which I get from taking the Poisson brackets of f and g and using the map Q to quantize it. So you see, kind of, if I was able to do that, I would really have preserved the full algebraic structure of the classical phase space. Because it's kind of a commutative diagram. If this holds here, then if I have two functions, I can do two different things. I can quantize them individually in terms of self-adjoint operators, then take the commutator bracket. And what this relation says, this is equivalent to first taking the classical Poisson bracket of the two functions and quantizing the resulting function. So I could, if I wanted to, I could draw a little commutative diagram to associate this last relation. I could, if the answer to this was a yes, but unfortunately the answer is no. So not even if we confine ourselves to kind of a reasonable set of functions, say those which are polynomial in the elementary Qs and Ps, not even then does this hold, does it go through. So let me write this down. So not even. So it's not true, not even if we consider just polynomials in the QI PI settling. So again, that's an important result. So it's named after people who works this out, Hunewald and von Hove. So there are two versions of that. 1946, well, I forget whom is due to, probably Hunewald, and 1951. And if you want to, you know, see a more careful discussion of this one, I have here a reference for something you can find online, a preprint by Giulini in QuantPhys 03042002. So this is a negative result. It simply means that there is no such thing as a quantization machine, even for this relatively simple finite dimensional context. You know, something, you know, I give you a phase space, which means I have these Poisson brackets, you know, and I turn a crank, and it just gives me some operator representation of the functions on this space, even if they're just a polynomial. Now, of course, what is true is that certain subalgebras one can find, subalgebras classically of the space C infinity of S, can be consistently quantized in the sense of this quantization map. So, for example, so what can be quantized consistently? Just to give you examples, so one doesn't have to despair completely, is, for example, the span of 1, that means linear span, qi, pi, qi squared, pi squared, and qi, the set of all qi, pj. And the way you deal with this QIPJ is you choose a symmetrized representation in the operators. And another example is the set of functions where you have 1, QI, PI, QI, PJ, QI, QJ, PK, and things that are, in general, no more than linear in the momenta. Sorry if you cannot read that. So it's just polynomials that are at most linear in the PIs. This you can also consistently quantize. Now, it gives you an idea of why you don't run into trouble if you consider really simple systems. And the really simple systems are those that are written down in your quantum mechanics books. Right? So, well, here's the span of the second thing where you have just linear terms in the piece. That's, of course, not much use because any self-respecting Hamiltonian will be quadratic in the momenta. Right? So this is not much use, perhaps. But here, of course, the standard, the harmonic oscillator is certainly in this set, and so which has just a kinetic term that looks like pi squared, and, well, a potential that is like qi squared. So we're not running into trouble with the harmonic oscillator unless we start insisting on quantizing more complicated phase-space functions. But usually this question doesn't actually pose itself. Now, just one warning remark. What unfortunately happens in gravity, the typical Hamiltonians you are considering, they cannot be fitted into this class here, or into either of these classes, if you like. So, and they typically have a so let me just, this is just a small last remark here. So if you look at gravity, of course, we are considering a field theoretic Hamiltonian. So the Qs and the Ps would be field coordinates and momenta. Okay, but just schematically, kinetic terms will be of the form some function, let me also call it f, of the qi's times kind of pi pj. So let me call it fij, pi pj. So the kinetic term will depend on both the coordinates and the momenta. And therefore, immediately you see that you'll certainly have kind of factor ordering issues here. And that holds even for very simple kind of cosmological models, so kind of reduced, symmetry reduced versions of gravity. So you see here, you get the first glimpse of an idea that this might not be entirely trivial. Okay, question here?
So what's the problem with cubic
terms? Yes, that's hopefully something you'll hopefully work out in this afternoon's exercises. I'm giving a side glance to Dennis. Yeah, you just see what you can do. Is you can try and recursively do polynomials. and at each step kind of do the quantization, perhaps take care of issues like that by going for, say, a symmetrized version of this, and then check, is this true? Are the Poisson brackets still preserved for my chosen quantization? If you do that recursively in the degree of the polynomials, you see that at order 3 you're running into trouble.
But just in, for example, if you are determining Q, your Poisson bracket and commutator are 0.
Sorry?
If you have just Q, for example, this term, the Poisson bracket is 0.
Yeah, Q and Q is 0.
The commutator is 0.
So yeah, but you're looking for a set that is closed, right, and where this can be applied consistently. And the statement of the theorem is, no, this doesn't work, but you can try and figure it out yourself, kind of, by doing the exercise. Can you be clever enough, to do this? Well, you cannot, because there's a theorem that works against you. But something we might.
This exercise will be for the next tutorial.
Okay. Is there a tutorial this afternoon or not?
Not.
Okay. Okay. Good. All right. So something to look forward to, and I'll see you back tomorrow.
Excuse.
Yeah.
Speaking about the quantum analogs to the Poisson brackets, you didn't really say anything about the analog to the Hamiltonian vector fields.
Well, you can see, for example, we see more. We come back to this in the lecture, but the way kind of this PI operates is that it retains.